This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong. Take me for granted.
This classic Aretha Franklin record was released exactly 28 years ago today. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with the co-writer of Do Right Woman, Dan Penn. He also co-wrote I'm Your Puppet, Dark End of the Street, and Cry Like a Baby. Penn was one of the key behind-the-scenes figures in 60s soul music as a songwriter and sometimes session guitarist in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Memphis, Tennessee. Otis Redding, Percy Sledge, Solomon Burke, and Arthur Alexander are among the singers who did his songs. Last year, Penn sang them himself on a CD called Do Right Man.
Yeah, yeah. They say that it's a man's world. But honey, you can't prove that by me. And as long as we're together, baby, show some respect for me. If you wanna do right, home days, woman, you gotta be a do right, home, not man.
Dan Penn co-wrote that with Chips Moman. They gave Aretha Franklin Do Right Woman when producer Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records took her to record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Jerry loved it. Aretha heard it. She liked it. But they both said, it doesn't have a bridge. It needs a bridge. And I agreed. So we headed for the closet, three of us, while the band was learning it. And we wrote the bridge, Aretha, Jerry, and I. They say that it's a man's world. All of that.
Now, the way the story, as I've read it, goes about the session in which Aretha recorded your song, Do Right Woman, was that it was a disaster at first.
It wasn't a disaster at first. It was a disaster later, but at first it was a wonderful session. Because they cut I Never Loved a Man, and it came off, well, you know, you heard it, it came off great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful session. Everybody was joyful, and it was great. And then later, when everybody got to drinking a little too much, not me. Not that time. So I was just watching all the haps go down. And there were a few incidents that happened at the studio and then later on at the hotel. I didn't even go to the hotel, so I didn't see the main fight, but I understood about it. But, you know, by the time the second song they cut, they only cut two songs, Never Loved a Man and Do Right Woman. And I mean, she didn't have time to learn the song. So I had to do the song. I had to do the palate vocal in her key with only a spinner on the organ and a little guitar chink and a drum and a bass hitting every once in a while. It sounded awful when they left Alabama with it. And I had no hopes that it would ever sound good at all. But later on, Chips and I came to New York, and we were at Atlantic Records, and Wexler, Jerry, said, come back here with me, boys, I'm going to play you something. He took us back to the Atlantic studio, and he played Aretha's. She had gone in and played piano and sang so great, and her sisters. And it was a great moment in our lives, and probably one of the highest places I ever heard, you know, ever felt for me. It was so wonderful.
When you record demos for a performer who's going to do one of your songs, do you try to sing in their style?
No, at one time I might have, but anymore I just try to sing the song some kind of honest way, that the way I feel it. I try to be neutral, kind of. Actually, I try to undersing just a little bit.
Why?
Don't obscure them, you know.
Oh, so that they could feel, well, that's okay, but I'll show you how it really should be done.
Well, now, you know, if it's a black singer, I would do the best I could, because they can always do better. But a lot of white singers, you have to kind of underplay it, because, excuse me, a lot of them can't really sing as good as maybe they could, you know. I mean, you scare them. You hit some notes or some little trills that maybe only you can do at that time, and they love it, and they try to do it, and it don't come off, and then, you know, there goes your song down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them a neutral, hey, here's a song, do your own thing. I try not to interpret.
Now, you grew up in Vernon, Alabama, which is about 80 miles south of Muscle Shoals. Alabama was very segregated when you were growing up. So what was it like for you when you started working with black artists and becoming part of black culture? Was it all very different to you? Were you ever uncomfortable around black culture? Or did you feel very comfortable right from the start?
I felt comfortable right from the start, and I stayed comfortable right up until, until it was over.
Until what was over? Soul music?
Yeah, you know. I think when they killed Martin Luther King, it was over.
What changed for you when Martin Luther King was killed?
Well, what changed for me was, you know, the black folks didn't want to make records with white people anymore. And so, since I was white, that kind of cut me out. And when we found that out, you know, we basically didn't want to do business either, so it was a bad time.
Were there people who you had been very close with musically who you weren't able to work with anymore?
No, it wasn't like that. It was just like an invisible line. A curtain was drawn across the color line as far as recording. I mean, it's something you felt. It's something you knew.
In the days before the King assassination, were you ever self-conscious about being a white songwriter in soul music?
Well, you knew you were, but I wasn't alone. I mean, there's Cropper and, you know, all these other cats, Chips and Spooner and you name it. I mean, you know, they were Carole King. I mean, they were all around. But, no, it wasn't a self-conscious thing. It was like, hey, this is wonderful. But it wasn't like I'm not supposed to be here. It was like, oh, how lucky I am.
Right.
And it was fun.
Songwriter Dan Penn is my guest. You worked at studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and in Memphis. Was there a difference in the sound at both of those studios?
Yes, it was different. Subtle differences. I always say that it's the air. But I guess it's everything that's there, you know. I mean, I worked in Muscle Shoals at Fame. It had this really great basic sound. And then when I got to Memphis, I could tell a considerably different sound. It was a more exciting sound. I don't know how to say except, you know, it's a river sound. And it's... Memphis is a lower level in altitude. So I always kind of think about altitudes for sounds. Memphis was lower, it was muddier, it was funkier, and it was even more fun. Nashville is higher up, and it's more clean, more pristine, you know, more... managed, less fun. Muscle Shoals is right in the middle. It has some of the funky grubby about Memphis in it, but it also has some Nashville cleanness about it. So, you know, any of them sounds good, but Muscle Shoals was the place I chose when I decided to cut the record.
Dan Penn recorded last year. He performs his own songs on the CD Do Right Man. Coming up, an interview with the producer of the record Do Right Woman, Jerry Wexler. This is Fresh Air. Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for my guest Jerry Wexler. Wexler was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 50s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he's worked with includes the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Etta James, and Solomon Burke. I spoke with Jerry Wexler in 1993 for a live broadcast from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Here's just a few of the records we have Jerry Wexler to thank for.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. See the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. When there's no
out of the sun,
under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be making love.
Under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.
Great stories about making this music in Jerry Wexler's new memoir. It's called Rhythm and the Blues, and it's just been published by Knopf. Jerry Wexler, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here, to plug my book.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old, and a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano.
Right.
You had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
What was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords. And the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together. And they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough Prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck trumpet player. And it got into what we call the dozens, the Southern Dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal. No piano. No background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that, starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's Little Southern Song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song."
Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who
right.
did you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what'd you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you wanted to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmet Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better known. What was he like in the beginning before he was very famous? What was he
Otis
like on stage?
Otis was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just solo Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why'd you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year, but our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going. It's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this Southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications, you go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas, bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
So you heard that
I heard the sound. I heard the sound, and I brought Pickett to Memphis, and we cut Midnight Hour and a lot of other things there, all in a hurry. It was great.
Jerry Wexler recorded in 1993, the year his autobiography, Rhythm and the Blues, was published. When Wexler took Wilson Pickett down to the Memphis studio of Stax Records, Pickett co-wrote some of his best-known songs with Stax House guitarist Steve Cropper. We'll hear from Cropper in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Steve Cropper, was the guitarist on some of the great soul hits of the 60s, records by Carla and Rufus Thomas, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, and Otis Redding.
I've been loving you too long.
stop now.
This 1965 Otis Redding classic was also produced by Steve Cropper. Cropper was the house guitarist, as well as a producer and songwriter, for Stax Records, the independent record company that defined the Memphis soul sound of the 60s. Cropper's reunited with former Stax House rhythm section Booker T and the MGs. Their latest recording, Cruisin', came out last October. Cropper has also been a member of the Blues Brothers band. When I spoke with Steve Cropper in 1990, he told me he thought his greatest strength as a guitarist was rhythm.
I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception. In the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
That's interesting, and also that they'd be able to work off of your rhythm while they were
performing. Yeah, they don't think of it in those terms because either they don't know me, they just know the aftermath of some of the things I've been lucky enough to be a part of. But I don't know if it's a gift or it's because I had such a love for, like I said, spiritual music in the beginning, that I have this talent that just sort of comes with finding the right groove for a song when I'm in the studio with an artist. And that seems to be the thing that always seems to make it, whether we're working with Rod Stewart. You know, I did a lot of stuff with Rod and Tommy Dowd, and I did a lot of the original stuff with Ringo and stuff. You know, when he did his solo albums and all. And those were the songs that seemed to make it up the charts, the ones that I was there on the ground for, helping the rhythm with the drummer and stuff like that.
You had your first hit with a band called The Marquees.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about who the band was and how you made the record.
Well, originally, Charlie Freeman and I, we started playing guitar with each other, and we just sort of had fun, and he was taking lessons, and he'd go to his lesson, and I'd wait for him at his house for him to get back, and he'd teach me what he learned that day. So I was kind of cheating the system a little bit, but anyway, we just started playing different things. We did some Elvis songs and some rock and roll and stuff like that, and we had a friend who thought that we were good. Obviously, we probably were pretty lousy at the time, but we didn't know that. And he said, "I've got a friend who's a disc jockey. He said, I'd like to take you guys down there and let him hear you, you know, and we're just young guys." So anyway, he took us down to his radio show one night. The guy's name was Keith Sheriff. And we went down there, and he said, "Okay, what do you guys got?" You know, we told him we've got some songs and so forth. He said, "Well, I want to hear you." And so he put us in a studio, the two of us, and opened up a mic. He said, "Now, you know, I'm doing my show now, but," he said, "I can hear you guys." And he said, "You just go ahead and do your thing, you know." So we started playing our stuff, you know, played a couple of songs, and he motioned for us to come in. And about that time, the phone started lighting up, and they were wanting to know, who were those two guys that they just heard? And I'm going, what's this? And he said, "Well, I didn't tell y'all, but," he said, "I put you out on the air." So anyway, all these people were calling, wanting to know who we were. And so he told us, he was pretty famous for his sock hops, and he'd have these sock hops every Saturday night at the National Guard Army. And he said, "If you guys get a drummer," he said, "I'll put you on my sock hop." And so we searched the school and found a guy in the ninth grade who played drums, Terry Johnson. And that was the first band, and we were called the Royal Spades. And shortly after that, we added Duck Dunn on bass, and we got Charlie Axton on saxophone, and Wayne Jackson on trumpet, and Don Nix on baritone, and formed the group The Marquees. And we had written this song with Jerry Lee Smoochie Smith on keyboards and wrote the instrumental last night. And I think they played it for Atlantic. Atlantic liked it. They pressed up a few copies and put it out on the radio, and lo and behold, it just took off like crazy. So that was our first success.
How old were you when you and the group The Marquees had the hit last night?
When the hit came out, I just graduated. It was the summer we graduated from high school. So I was, 19, 18?
Now, it wasn't long after that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section. You became a producer. You became a songwriter. With
floor sweeper.
Yeah, right.
Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with the Marquise?
He was a tenor player with the Marquise. He was on the record last night and everything. He came to me and he said, I hear you guys got a pretty good band. He said, you know, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band. And I said, well, I'm not really interested. Well, I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group. And I said, how long have you been playing, you know? And he said, oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months. And I'm going, oh, yeah, great, you know. And somewhere in the conversation, he goes, oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio. And I said, can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday? And that is a true story. Now, I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around, and then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label, and we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And of course, Jim Stewart said that we never had a chance, we'd never make it, but I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something, and we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day, and until the time that we came up with last night. But what happened was, Estelle, I don't know, Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop. And I sold records. That's what I did. And I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in. And on Saturdays, I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that. And that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, wait a minute. He said, you know, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in the record shop and whatever. And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions. And I think this was it's a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquees, and we had this big hit record last night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I'd already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Robey. I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al TNT Braggs. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, and everybody just fell in love with him.
Let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T and the MGs.
Thank you.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is guitarist Steve Cropper. He was one of the house producers and in the house rhythm section of Stax Records during the 1960s and part of the 70s. Cropper has co-written many classic songs, such as Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding and In the Midnight Hour with Wilson Pickett. And he's part of the band Booker T and the MGs. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist Steve Cropper is my guest. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock at the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. That's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and I'm sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over, and I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really, he might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform. And that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that. And that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked, worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with, and I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home.
Was it your idea to have the ocean sound effects in on the record?
Yeah. Atlantic said they were a little too loud, but I stuck in there. I kept them in. I thought the birds in the ocean was great.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour. And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there and presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple of ideas, and what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel. And Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written and Don't Fight It. They said, we're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going. And they left and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits. Very lucky me, huh?
Well, let's hear In the Midnight Hour.
I'm going to wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm going to wait till the midnight hour. When there's no one else around. I'm going to take you, girl, and hold you. And do all the things I told you.
Our interview with Steve Cropper was recorded in 1990. We'll hear more interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. John Sayles began his career as a novelist and a short story writer in the 70s, and then began supplementing his income as a B-movie screenwriter. His first film as a director, The Return of the Secaucus Seven, was made in 1979 on a budget of $40,000. Since then, he's become one of the most prominent and prolific independent filmmakers. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Sayles' latest movie, The Secret of Roan Inish.
John Sayles has always been most convincing to me, not as a director or even as a writer, but as a mimic. He does terrific imitations of black street talk in The Brother from Another Planet and City of Hope, and white street talk in City of Hope and Baby It's You. And in movies like Mate One and Eight Men Out, he gets white country talk down as well. Maybe after covering the American waterfront, he decided he needed new worlds, or rather old worlds, to conquer. Because The Secret of Roan Inish plays like a celebration of the Irish brogue. It's an unusual film for Sayles, a storybook fantasy based on the legends of island fishermen. And though Sayles has never been very proficient with the niceties of mood and atmosphere, this movie has a genuine Irish tang. The skies are bleak and the winds blow across the heaths, the gray sea sprays, and among its rocks bob the alien-looking heads of seals. In fact, seals are a lot of what this movie is about, but not in any corny, free-willy way. The seals inhabit the rocks around Roan Inish, the mysterious green island where young Fiona Keneally, and indeed all the Keneallys, hail from. But during World War II, the island is evacuated, and amid the commotion, a tragic accident occurs. Little Fiona's even littler brother, Jimmy, is washed away to sea in his floating cradle, and after that it seems doom hangs over the Keneally family. They desert the island of Roan Inish, and Fiona, at the age of about 10, winds up living with her grandparents across the bay. There's something special about Fiona. Everybody sees it. She attracts people who want to tell her the legends of her family, especially the legend of her ancestor Liam, a loner who was out fishing one day when he saw a seal transform itself into a beautiful woman.
All the islanders had seen Liam row out to sea alone. And now all saw his return with the strange girl. Island people is a careful lot. Not likely to pass judgment on another person's business in public. There was something so unearthly about the girl that soon set their tongues to wagging. And there was much shaking of heads when Liam married the stranger. She hardly spoke at all, and when she did, her Irish was queer sounding. More ancient than their grandfather's grandfathers. And when they asked him where he'd found her, with her great dark eyes and her wild black hair, he'd only say Trabeg. Of course, this was nonsense, as it was only a speck in the ocean that even the seals had to leave when the tide was high. And she'd always be at the water. looking out at the seals and the birds.
That particular legend is the best one in the film, and that's partly because it's told by the movie's only first-rate actor, John Lynch, who may be familiar as Daniel Day-Lewis's friend and betrayer in The Name of the Father. Unfortunately, a lot of the other acting in this movie is pedestrian or worse, and Sayles' Irish yarn spinning, though very authentic sounding, is also very stiff. Practically every line sounds written and rewritten. Still, after a cripplingly pokey beginning, the movie's mood begins to take hold. The secret that still draws Fiona to Rowan Inish begins to draw us, too, and Haskell Wexler's blunt, dark-toned cinematography brews its own magic. Kids may be bored at times, but at other times they'll be enchanted. And even for grown-ups, there's something heartening about a movie that makes its fantasy not from canned cartoon characters singing sunny songs, but from seabirds and rocky coasts and the strange, filtered light of Ireland.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Fred Snyder. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.